This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Chris Velasco, and it is so much fun to have a chance to talk with you again. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's always a lot of fun.
You know, The Invisible Hours is, you know, it's hard to describe. It's not really a game in the traditional sense. It's obviously not a film. I think the developers at Tequila Works call it interactive theater, but it has totally sucked me in, and it must have been such a fun project to work on.
Yeah, you know, when they first got in touch with me about doing the score for this, and they were trying to describe it, and I just had no idea what they were talking about. And honestly, I'm not a big theater fan, and so I heard interactive theater, and I was like, oh boy. And just wasn't really excited about it at all. But I love the guys from Tequila Works. I met them in Spain a couple of years ago, and I knew I wanted to work with them. So, you know, of course I said, yeah, I would love to work on it. And then they started sending me the scripts, and there's a, you know, script for each character in the game. And they sent me 4 out of the 7, I think. And I was completely sucked in and, you know, read them all that afternoon and then hit them back up on Skype, you know, begging for the last 3 scripts because I had to find out what happened. And yeah, it's one of these games that it's hard to describe what the experience is. You just need to try it out for yourself.
Yeah. And on the surface, it seems fairly straightforward. It's just a good old fashioned murder mystery. And Nikola Tesla is the victim. And, you know, that's kind of plausible because he rubbed so many people the wrong way, including
right.
Thomas Edison, who's also one of the characters. But then there are some really interesting fictional characters, like his secretary Flora and Augustus Vandenberg, who is heir to an industrialist fortune. So getting to know these characters must have been such an interesting part of the process.
Yeah, because they're definitely, you know, on the surface, you think, okay, this is like Vandenberg, like, okay, he's the spoiled rich kid, and we all know Edison, and then there's Bernhardt, and like, okay, famous actress, and the way the game presents them is they're really deep characters, and you would think, you know, from the beginning, kind of like any murder mystery, it's like, okay, I know who the bad guy is, like. But as you follow each of these characters around in Tesla's mansion, you realize they're not all they're cracked up to be, and each one has a plausible reason for being there and potentially killing Tesla.
Yeah, and it's really interesting the way there's no way to play it through start to finish like you would a linear game with a really straightforward story, because things are happening in the game while you're a fly on the wall listening to one character or two characters. So it's so interesting to have that mechanic where you have to kind of back up and rewind, and the game lets you do that, or you can redo a chapter and then follow other characters. So did that have any impact on how you created the music or how you even started to think about what the music would do?
So when I started, I wasn't really sure about the mechanics of the game. Like I was still trying to wrap my head around, like, okay, so you're not actually playing anything, you're just watching, like. And that seemed, honestly, it seemed a little bit boring when I first heard about it, until again when I read the scripts, and then I did fly out to Madrid and meet with the team, and I got to play the game a little bit, and then it kind of all clicked in, and I was like, oh my god, this game is, it's gonna sort of in a way revolutionized storytelling. So I don't want to say that completely affected the music, other than it does play out in a linear fashion, even though, like you said, you can fast forward and rewind and to make sure you're hitting all the character storylines, or you can just, you know, replay through the whole thing, follow each person, which is kind of what I like to do. So it became this thing. It's like, okay, well, the game could potentially, you know, where you're going could potentially be many, many, many hours of gameplay. But I've found that in writing for virtual reality, since you are living the experience, that too much music can kind of pull you out of the whole experience, because it feels like you're not playing a game. It feels like you're there. And so it'd kind of be like, you know, oh, I'm walking to my car and I'm hearing some music. I'm driving down the street, like I'm hearing some music. Like it just, that makes no sense at all. So we just wanted to pick very certain key scenes to, and then emphasize those with music. But then there's, they are very location specific. And so it's possible to play through the entire game and not even hear music if you're not hitting these key scenes.
Wow.
Yeah, that was kind of a weird thing to wrap our head around as well. And because it's like, okay, like for instance, in the beginning of the game, when you find Tesla's body, there's a cue like leading up to the mansion and then finding the body. And then there's a bit of silence while some of the characters get introduced. And then suddenly, you know, someone's like, there's someone running outside. And it's kind of the stereotypical bad guy, Mundy, who has climbed out a window because he thinks, oh God, they're going to blame me for this. I got to get out of here. And he takes off running. And so we were thinking, oh, we got to do a big action cue for that when you're chasing him. But you could also at the same time not be following that. You could watch the whole thing from inside the house. You could be outside and then not see him, you know, because he's running around the corner. It all kind of depends on your own vantage point. And so we experimented a lot with things like that. Like, okay, how do we even score these scenes if you have an opportunity to view it from so many different angles? And will this be awkward, you know, if we do something big here, if you're not even really seeing it? So I think I've gone off on a tangent, so I'm not even sure what the original question was.
Well, it was just kind of how your sort of initial ideas about how the music would be implemented. And what I was thinking more is that because, you know, probably a lot of players would repeat scenes or come at them from different experiences, if the music would get kind of repetitive. But in fact, it sounds like the opposite is true, if you can completely miss some of the cues depending on how you walk through the mansion and who you eavesdrop on. So that's a challenge that I don't think not anyone I have ever talked with has had to deal with before. So that's really...
Yeah, I mean, there could be a scene that's scored and you could be on the other side of the mansion, but it's playing out in real time, you know, somewhere else in the mansion. And if you happened to walk in midway on that, you would be, you know, they're not going to restart and start over because you're just this invisible observer. So, you know, Edison and, you know, Mundy, for example, could be having an argument and perhaps that scene is scored. You wouldn't know what's going on. You wouldn't know there's music playing. But if you happen to turn the corner and bump into them, you would see it midway through. But then the score was playing the entire time, and so you kind of just interrupt the music and the scene. And it was kind of weird to wrap my head around.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And when you were working with Tequila Works, you know, a lot of times a composer will write a cue and not really even know where it's going to end up in the finished game. But it sounds like you guys worked really closely together.
Oh yeah, we spent a lot of time going through the game. That was one reason why I went to visit them. Like, we spent 2 or 3 days just going through all the video of the actors, you know, doing their motion capture, going through all these scenes. So I wasn't really even seeing the game at that point. We're just seeing, you know, all these guys in their silly, you know, body tight, you know, motion capture, you know, outfits.
With all the little dots on them.
With all the little dots on them. Going through the motions. And so we would watch these tapes and then think like, okay, this seems like a really important part. Like, let's earmark this for music. And we did this a lot. And then I would write some music and see, like, does it fit? Does it not? Should we change the scene? Should we make it longer, shorter, whatever? But we definitely went through and spotted it like it was a movie, because essentially it is just a big interactive movie.
Yeah, it's just so cool, and it's so different from anything else that I've experienced before. And you've mentioned that you did score it like a film with no looping. So did that make it easier or harder than writing typical game music?
Oh, I think way easier. I've done it a lot, and I still find game music much more difficult to write than film or TV.
Is that just because you have to, in most cases, kind of take into account what you can break into stems and how you're going to layer things for loops?
Yeah, just that, or a lot of times when I'm writing a loop for a game, I may not even have much of a visual reference at all. And then it's just like writing, you know, countless 3-minute combat loops that are kind of just whatever I feel like doing. And you hope that it kind of matches the gameplay. And then you, of course, you test it out. And if it doesn't, you tweak things here and there. But when you're writing to picture, you know, the picture obviously dictates what the music is going to do, and it forces you to make creative decisions that you might not otherwise.
Yeah. You know, and then the additional challenge you had is that this is a period piece. You know, it's set at the end of the 19th, early 20th centuries. And so what were some of the challenges that came with writing music for a game that's set in such a specific time period?
We decided not to go, like, purely historic with the music or make it like too period, but I of course wanted the music to have some sense of that while still feeling, you know, a little bit like a modern film score. One thing for sure is that I wanted it to be strictly orchestral, except for the parts where we discovered something in Tesla's mansion that was like his time machine. Or there's that whole seance scene and they're using his spirit box and so I thought, okay, here's a bit of like kind of like sci-fi that's mixed in to reality. So this might be a place to bring in a little bit of a synthetic texture on top of the orchestra. And then as far as kind of making it sound a little bit period, I always feel like a combination of plucked things like a cymbalom and maybe plucked piano strings and a harp. For some reason, that kind of plucked texture is almost harpsichordish in nature, but not exactly.
Yeah.
And I feel like adding that particular texture, especially in this score with just the regular orchestra that it kind of did lend itself to feeling more of a period score. Thank you.
Yeah, it definitely did. And the seance was one of the cues specifically that I wanted to talk with you about, because you did bring in those really unusual sounds. I mean, not like you did with Resident Evil, but it sounds like you played around with some, like, found sounds to give it that really interesting otherworldly quality.
Yeah, I actually used some pipes, and then the sound of banging on these pipes or rubbing these pipes or whatever made this kind of interesting metallic, glassy, almost kind of pad. And so I used a lot of that stuff, but then kind of reversed the textures just to give it that other slight bit of otherworldliness to them. And that kind of became the sound of any of Tesla's kind of lab stuff.
Yeah, it was really cool. And it really kind of reinforces, I think, you know, when you go to a, I haven't been to a seance, but the ones that I've seen on TV or in films, you know, there is this sort of anticipation and dread and suspense, you know, who's going to show up. And so so that cue in particular really, I think, was a great fit for that. It was really, really effective.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and that particular cue, besides just the seance going on, in the game, they kind of find this spirit box, and they're like, oh, let's have a seance, you know, it'll be fun. And it's kind of a, starts out as almost a goofy moment, but then there's this tension between Bernhardt and Mundy, and that's kind of where it gets a little more dramatic at the end, is she's like, I'm leaving, I got to get out of here, and he's kind of grabbing her, he's like, no, you're staying, and that's... yeah, I think the kind of choir like kicks in at the end, and it kind of crescendos up into this big kind of atonal chord, and then she finally kind of rips away, and that's kind of the end of that scene.
It's really dramatic and really scary because, again, you know, you've got these otherworldly sounds. And you've said that writing for horror and suspense, whether it's for TV or film or a game, gives you so much freedom. And I would love to know why you think that is. Is it because it's so out of normal experience that, like, all bets are off and you don't really have any expectations?
Yeah, exactly. I mean... anything really goes with that sort of genre. You can have something beautiful in there and it becomes almost much more dramatic. It's kind of a juxtaposition of, you know, Beauty and the Beast sort of thing. Or you can have the purely atonal sounds or harsh, distorted electronic sounds or anything really. But because the audience is already expecting something horrible to happen, it kind of frees their mind up to experience that music in a way they wouldn't if it was, you know, in a comedy or something. It would feel so out of place, and you'd be like, you know, who the hell writes like this? I can't listen to this music. This is awful. But you know, you put something scary on the screen, and that music just fits in so perfectly. Yeah, so that's why I love doing it, because really anything goes.
Yeah, and there are other cues too in this soundtrack where you've got a bit of that. One of the cues that I was thinking about in particular is Face Facts, where it's such a blend of these different things. There's a very simple waltz, and you've got some beautiful writing for winds, but then you've got these really creepy harmonics that come in on the strings. And so which character does that represent, or what, maybe you could describe the scene for us where we would hear that?
Yeah, it's, so if you haven't played the game, it's a bit of a spoiler, but it comes fairly early. I think it's in chapter one of the game, and I think at this point the game's been out for a month or so, so at some point you just have to say, you know, we're going to talk about it. it's not the day after the, you know, Game of Thrones. We've had a month, so I think it's okay to divulge the secret. So yeah, the character Bernhardt, the famous actress, she is in her room and kind of powdering her nose and looking in the mirror and you know, looking very beautiful. But there's something, she's kind of talking to herself and something is kind of off a little bit. And I just thought that this kind of creepy-ish waltz just fit the mood. But then where the really like kind of atonal strings come in on top of the waltz is she pulls her nose off.
Oh, that's where that is.
And yeah, so she was in, I won't give everything away, but there was a horrible accident when she was a child, and she had to have massive reconstructive surgery. Now, I don't know if this is only for the game. I honestly don't know much about Bernhardt, so I have a feeling that's probably not what happened in real life. But for the purposes of the game, she was disfigured. And so the nose comes off, and she's like cleaning her face and then re-glues her nose back onto her face. And that's where the waltz kind of starts to fade out and crumble, and the kind of atonal strings sort of take over. And she's still sort of talking to herself and kind of dancing around the room, and you're like, oh my God, she is crazy.
Yeah, and that cue has that sort of really off-kilter this isn't where I thought we were going with this kind of feel to it, which is really, really cool.
Right.
There's another really, really touching moment with Augustus Vanderburg, who's the son of this really wealthy industrialist, and he lost his brother. His brother drowned, and his father felt like the better brother had passed away, and Augustus is just a complete waste of space. So Augustus is about ready to commit suicide, and that cue that you wrote, another dead son, is absolutely heartbreaking. It's just so effective. And again, I think it really shows how much your music reinforces these characters. Was he one of the characters that you were especially like sympathetic to?
You know, I didn't identify with him so much, but yeah, absolutely. I was, you know, you can't help but feel sympathetic towards him because, you know, all he wants to do is make his father proud. And yeah, in that moment he decides, well, probably the only thing I could do that would make him proud is to kill myself. So he tries to take an overdose of laudanum. But yeah, I think overall, I think my favorite character was probably Bernhardt.
Oh.
And I kind of wrote all my favorite cues for her scenes as well.
Wow. I think what's so interesting, and this really speaks to the writing for the game, is how fleshed out these people are, that you can have a favorite character and someone that you can really, at least, maybe if not identify with, but certainly give them a real personality with the music.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It felt completely different than working on a game where you know, you are writing themes for characters, but kind of at the end of the day, I don't really care about those characters that much. You know, you're playing and it's like, okay, whatever, that guy's got a theme, but, you know, it's just cool to hear when he's on screen or whatever, but I have no emotional ties to him. But with Invisible Hours, you do feel like you get to know these people pretty intimately, and I think that absolutely influenced my writing for them.
Yeah, you mentioned that this is a soundtrack that you're really especially proud of. Can you share why that is?
I just think that it just feels like more of my personal voice in this soundtrack. I'm sure that I've developed a style over the years. I've written probably close to, if not more than 100 video game scores. So you'd expect to develop a style over that time, but so much of it is just, you know, I've been known for a lot of the bombastic, you know, epic, huge orchestral stuff. And I do really love writing that, but I haven't had much of an opportunity to write these, like, something a little more character driven like this. And I just felt myself just really, really loving the process. And, you know, it's not the most complex writing I've ever done, but there's just something that felt very, like, honest and true about it. And I would love to do more projects like this.
Yeah, it's really packed with so much emotion. I mean, just even right off the bat with the main theme. I mean, you've got so much going on there. There's a lot of forward motion and all the way through that cue and then many others, there's suspense. But I think you're right. I think it's writing for maybe a smaller ensemble that makes it feel more personal.
Yeah, there's definitely that too. I had this idea when we were first talking about the score, this before a single note had been written, but I thought, you know, what if we did it sort of like Peter and the Wolf, where every character had not only their own theme, but their own instrument. You know, like the bird is the flute, the
clarinet is the cat.
Right. And so I experimented with that, not so much writing-wise, but just more kind of at the conceptual stage. And everybody thought that would be a really cool idea. And then at the end, I just kind of decided, no, I would need to spend so much time working this out. And if we had, you know, a year or 2 years to work on the music for this game, I would have totally tried it. But it just felt like at the end of the day, it was going to be a little bit gimmicky. And the score wouldn't be as effective for it. So I dropped that notion, but I still like the idea in theory. Yeah, so let's say Flora is the flute, and we'll say, I don't know, I was going to assign like percussion to Mundy, but then, you know, if they had a moment, and I don't think they actually do, but I was just imagining like, okay, if I'm limiting myself to only flute and timpani, this is going to be a bit weird.
Yeah.
and again, yeah, in theory, that's kind of neat, but boy, I'm going to need a lot of time to figure out how to really implement that in a way that doesn't come off as just being dumb. So I abandoned that idea, obviously. But then we did think, okay, a smaller ensemble, you know, it's a small cast. And I just felt like a big orchestra you know, a big orchestra just has this sheen to it, and it's just big and majestic, and I don't feel like this was the project for that. It needed to be a smaller ensemble.
Yeah, and what's cool about it, too, is that it's, you know, maybe the right size to fit in an orchestra pit, so that if you were, you know, to carry through the sort of premise that it's theater and you were sitting in the audience, that is maybe about how big the orchestra would be.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, it's a really good fit, you know, with the scale of the game, too. And I love how you started the soundtrack with the orchestra tuning. I thought that was a really nice touch.
I hadn't written anything for when you start the game, because it didn't exist in time for when I had to be done with the music and get it recorded. But they were explaining it to me, and it's like, oh, you walk into the theater and you get a ticket, and there's, you know, the big red curtain. And I was like, you know, it might be cool to just record the orchestra tuning up, like it's the, you know, like we're about to, like you were saying, like there was a pit orchestra, although I wasn't really thinking in terms of the size because of the pit, but that does make sense. But I thought, yeah, you know, they're tuning up. It's like, hey, the show's about to start, you know, orchestra's tuning up, you know, let's grab your ticket and get in here. So yeah, I just quickly, I asked the Pro Tools guy when we were recording, I said, hey, when they're tuning, just record them real quick. and I thought it worked out great. And then I wasn't sure if it would be silly or not to include it as the first track of the soundtrack. But at the end of the day, I thought, yeah, I kind of like it. And if people don't, they can just, you know, skip it.
Every once in a while, it'll turn up on Shuffle, like right in the middle of things, which is a little bit weird. But I think what it also does, I mean, every time I'm at a concert and the orchestra starts tuning, there's this sense of anticipation, too, which is really neat. And it also, you know, it kind of coalesces everything when finally, after all the little twitters and flutters and people messing with their instruments, then you get that one unified sound, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Chris, it has been so much fun to talk with you about this, and it must have been a nice experience to take a break from, oh, the horror of Resident Evil and your sci-fi show, and it really shows. It's really a wonderful score, so thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it.
Yeah, thank you, and I'm really glad that you liked the score. It means a lot to me.